Thank you, choir. Paul told me last summer that he had this beautiful anthem, Blessed Are the Pure in Heart. And I said, that will be great because we're doing this Bible study on the Beatitudes. And when you sing it in November, we will be finished with our study on the Beatitudes. Well, the bad news is we're not finished. We're going to have to pick up after the first of the year. But the good news is, this past week, we looked at the words, Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. I'm holding in my hand a document that is revolutionary. A document that has the power to be transformational. A document that can change your life, that can change this church, this community, and change the world. This can turn the world upside down. And for those of you who are listening to this service on the radio, the document that I have in my hand is the Bible. Now, I have my old duct tape version, because this is an old Bible that I've used for years. But it doesn't matter whether you have a new version, an old version. It doesn't matter what translation. It doesn't matter whether you can physically hold the Bible in your hand or whether you access it on your iPad, your iPhone, your smartphone, whatever method. This Bible, these words, can make a difference in your life this very day. Now, people say that's a big book. There's 66 books. There's Old Testament. There's New Testament. There are laws. There are Paul's letters and all of this stuff. If I really want to get to the heart of this transformation that you're talking about, what would you suggest? I would say go to the book of Matthew, chapters 5, 6, and 7, to the words that we call the Sermon on the Mount. Beginning with the Beatitudes that Ethan read for us just a few moments ago. The Beatitudes, blessed are the pure in heart. Remember Dr. Tom Long said, the Sermon on the Mount is the constitution of the church, and the Beatitudes are its preamble. Nothing like this has ever been written before. Nothing like this has ever been proclaimed. And I don't think we realize what power we have when we take these words of Jesus seriously. It's been a few years, but I know there was a movement a few years ago in a lot of different communities, including our community, that people wanted to post the Ten Commandments in a public place. Let's put the Ten Commandments up at the courthouse. Let's put the Ten Commandments up at the governmental center. I have no doubt that if we took a vote in Davidson County on posting the Ten Commandments, that it would pass overwhelmingly. But I wonder, if we took a vote, if we suggested posting not the Ten Commandments, but the Beatitudes. Because you remember, Jesus said, you've heard it said of old. On that mountain, Moses came and he brought the law. You've heard it said of old, but I say unto you. And what Jesus is doing is he's reinterpreting the law. He's turning the old law of Moses on its head, turning it upside down. Do you think people would be as excited about posting, Blessed are the merciful? That they would be as excited, Blessed are the peacemakers? Blessed are the poor in spirit? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness? What does it say about us that we might get more excited about the law of Moses, the old way, than we do the revolutionary words of Jesus? These words are so important that when Jesus concluded the Sermon on the Mount, he told a parable. He said, if you follow these words, You're going to be like a man who builds his house on a rock. This is a solid foundation for life. But if you ignore these words, you're going to be like a man who builds his house on the sand. As soon as there's bad weather or some other problem, that house is going to fall away. But the house that is built on the solid foundation will be the house that will stand. And then we hear that people were absolutely amazed at his teachings. They had never heard anyone who taught with the authority, with the boldness, with the compelling nature of Jesus, and large crowds followed him. It was the beginning of the public ministry in the book of Matthew. The Beatitudes, these powerful words, define the very nature of the kingdom of God. Jesus talked about the kingdom, that we're supposed to be kingdom people, kingdom builders. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that we're merciful. It means that we're peacemakers. It means that we hunger and we thirst for righteousness. It means that we are pure in heart. But one of the things that we learned in this study, and when I saw this perspective, I said, well, this makes a lot of sense. Because I can read the Beatitudes and I say, well, maybe I'll do pretty good here, but not so good here. Maybe I hunger and thirst for righteousness. Maybe I'm not always a peacemaker. Maybe I'm not always merciful. Now, we should be, but we're not. But you have to remember that this is addressed to the community of faith. And what Jesus is sharing with us, these are not entry requirements into the kingdom, but rather these are descriptions of what the kingdom looks like. And the people who are in the kingdom with the giftedness of their blessings, of their gifts, of their abilities, of their nature, you put it all together and you have the Beatitudes. And so you might notice in a few minutes this morning, we're going to, when we take the offering, we're going to have you stand not in unison, but in ordered rows, which you've been doing really well with lately. So I want you to think about this as we stand. There's some of us who are peacemakers. Not everyone, but some. There's some who are merciful. There's some who hunger and thirst for righteousness. But in just a moment, we'll all be standing together as the church of Jesus Christ. The Beatitudes are declarations of the blessedness of this community and any community of faith. But the key that binds them all together are the words that the choir just presented to us in such a beautiful way. Blessed are the pure in heart. Now, you may have noticed that the first scripture passage that Ethan read, you read very well this morning, the very first passage was from the 24th Psalm, in which the psalmist asked the question, who shall ascend to the mountain of the Lord? Who shall stand in the holy place? And the answer is those who have clean hands and a pure heart. And by the way, that was an antiphonal psalm. And so what would happen is, like, you all be the priestly crowd up here, you kind of look priestly with your robes on, and you're the pilgrims. So you've been on a journey to Jerusalem, to the holy place, and once you arrive, you stand on the Mount of Olives, and you look out over the temple and over the walls of the city, and you cry out, who shall ascend to the mountain of the Lord? Who shall enter the holy place? That's your destination. And then on the inside, the response was, those who have clean hands and a pure heart. And it goes back and forth. It's a beautiful, beautiful psalm. Maybe we ought to try it like that. It's good on Palm Sunday to do something and with an antiphonal response. But you know what they meant when they said clean hands and a pure heart? They simply meant people who kept the rituals, people who followed the letter of the law, people who did everything they were supposed to do, and who did not do the things that were forbidden. You know, in the Old Testament, there are all these foods that we can eat and all these foods we can't eat. And it even says in the Old Testament, you can't go to the barbecue festival. I mean, for some reason, you couldn't eat pork. Well, now Jesus came along and said, no, you can go to the barbecue festival, and Ray Howell's going to bless it, so it'll be okay. I think that's what he said. It's something like that. But Jesus changed everything. He redefined the law. But it's more than just ritual. Because Jesus said, well, anybody can follow the law. Anybody can look good on the outside. But the key is, what's on the inside? The key is, what's down deep in your heart? Purity of heart. I've had a problem with this for a long, long time. Because I think most of us, if we were in a discussion group and we'd say, well, Jesus said, blessed are the pure in heart, what does that mean? And I think most of us would say, well, people who do the right thing, people who don't have any bad thoughts, people who are never selfish, never envious, people who never hold a grudge, people who are always eager to forgive, people who never do anything wrong. So where does that leave me? I mean, if any of you qualify, go ahead and raise your hand. I don't think any of us meet those requirements, because we've always interpreted the pure in heart as moral purity. But I came across a new perspective. A new perspective that I think gives us an insight and a compelling insight into these ancient words. The basic prayer of the Jewish faith is called the Shema. It's a prayer that every Jew recites twice a day when they wake up in the morning before they go to bed at night. It is the first words of Scripture that a Jewish child will learn to recite, the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And we shall love the Lord our God with all of our heart, and with all of our soul, and with all of our might. But the Lord is one, and we shall love the Lord our God with a heart that is undivided, with a commitment that is total, unequivocal, undiluted, a singular love. Purity of heart means that I don't have a divided heart, that I don't have two allegiances, that I don't say, well, I'll honor God on Sunday, but don't bother me on Monday. That sort of thing. Never have really thought about it that way before. And then I came across the words of the Danish philosopher and theologian Søren Kierkegaard, who lived back in the mid-19th century, but continues to influence Christianity today. One of the greatest devotional books he wrote is simply titled, Purity of Heart is to Will One Thing. One thing. Well, that's sort of what Jesus was saying in different places. Remember the parable that he told about the merchant that was in search of fine pearls? He wanted all of these pearls, but suddenly He finds one pearl of great value. So what does he do? He goes and... It's okay. What does he do? He goes and sells everything he has. And he purchases the one pearl. One thing. Paul said, "This one thing that I do, forgetting what lies behind, I'm straining forward to the upward calling. This one thing that I do, to know Christ and to know Him in the power of the resurrection." But the story I love the most is the story of Mary and Martha. A great story when Jesus and His disciples have come to the home of Mary and Martha. And of course, they're so honored to have Jesus in their home. He was their best friend. And Jesus considered Mary, Martha, and Lazarus to be His closest friends outside the disciples. And so when somebody you love comes to your home, and I know a lot of you are already thinking about Thanksgiving when your family members are coming, what do? You get busy preparing a delicious meal. And we have a table that is overflowing with good food, because this is one way that we show love to our family and to those who are so important. So here's Martha, and she's busy in the kitchen. She's working on getting all the things ready for that wonderful meal. So what's Mary doing? She's not at choir practice, I'll tell you that. So Mary's in there just kind of hanging out with Jesus and the guys, you know, listening to Jesus. And here's Martha in the kitchen, and here's Mary, and here's Martha. And finally, Martha's had enough, and she comes in there and she scolds Mary. Now, that would never happen in a home today. It's not going to happen at Thanksgiving, is it? When your sister-in-law shows up, well, we won't go there. So she said, "What are you doing? I need your help." Mary said, "Well, I was in here listening to Jesus." But you remember what Jesus said? He kind of scolds Martha. And this is exactly what he said. He said, "Martha, Martha, you are so worried and distracted over many, many things. But Mary has chosen the better. There is need of only one thing." One thing. Kierkegaard said, "To the intellect, wisdom, to comprehend that one thing," this is actually a prayer, "to the heart, sincerity, to receive this and this only, the one thing, to the will, purity that wills only one thing, in prosperity that you may grant perseverance to will one thing, amid distractions, collectedness to will one thing, in suffering, patience to will one thing." What is the one thing? What is the most important thing that we should do? What is it that Jesus had in mind when he said to Martha, "There is need for only one thing"? It is simply this: to know God. To know God, to be in communion with Him, to live as a child of God. To know God is the one thing. But the story of my life, and I bet some of you can identify with me, is I am so worried and distracted over so many things. And sometimes it's the many things that get me distracted, and I can't focus on the one thing. Just recently, when Joyce's nephew was so sick, and when he died, we were reminiscing about all of the wonderful things about his life. William Jr. loved to play softball. That was a passion of his, and it started when he was a child. In our little community in Jones County, there was a children's baseball team. William Jr. was on that team, and our oldest daughter, Lynn, was on that baseball team. It was a community effort. All of the churches in the community made a contribution so that the kids could have a great time playing baseball. One of the first lessons that I learned as a pastor, when I went to that little church, it was my first church, I was still in seminary. Somewhere along the way, I didn't get the memo that everybody in church doesn't act like a Christian. I sort of missed that day. So here I was, young and idealistic, and I went and met Buddy. Buddy was the coach of the Little League baseball team. And I was happy to meet him because I love baseball, and here he was working with these kids. And Buddy said, oh, by the way, said, you know, all the churches go together and make a contribution, and it's time for our annual contribution. What do I need to do? I said, Buddy, you don't need to do a thing. I'll take care of that. So in our little church, we had our deacons who met every Sunday morning before worship for prayer and business. And I went in there and said, guys, the baseball team needs their money. I met Buddy. One of them said, yep, good old Buddy. You know he's a member of this church? No. You never seen him, have you? Good old Buddy. Always asking, never giving, good old Buddy. Maybe if good old Buddy might decide to come to church more often, we might be more willing to make a contribution. Hadn't thought about it that way. Now, you got to remember, I was young, idealistic, naive, and stupid. So I went back to good old Buddy and said, Buddy, if you'd come to church more often. Well, that's when the trouble started. And it was only a few weeks later that good old Buddy and his whole family were sitting in my office on a Saturday morning with letters of resignation. A mountain had become out of a molehill. And we had a major, major issue on our hands. Now, if the deacons had been focused on the one thing, never would have been an issue. If the preacher had had a little bit more common sense and focused on the one thing, it never would have been an issue. If the family had been focused on one thing, it never would have been an issue. But isn't that the way it works in churches? You know, I found out early on, it's not the big issues that are going to create problems in the church. It's the little things. It's things that don't really matter. It's the things that keep us from focusing on the one thing that become issues and become problems. To know God. To know God. If you look at that revolutionary document, the Sermon on the Mount, that is the Constitution of the Church, do you know what you find in the very center of the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, smack dab in the middle. It's Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And in the middle of chapter 6, you find the Lord's Prayer. And at the very center of the Lord's Prayer, you find the words, Thy will be done. To know God, to pray Thy will be done, is to focus on the one thing. It's asking God to be God. It's asking God to do not what we want, but what He wants. If we're asking God to be God, according to Frederick Buechner, we better get prepared, because it's going to unleash the tiger out of the cage. It's going to make atomic power look like a warm breeze, because this document can change the world. This document can change our life, but only if we focus on the one thing that is important, the one thing that is needful, the one thing that will lead us to God. And the promise is that we will see God. One of the most faithful Christians who ever lived was Fanny Crosby. We actually are using two of her hymns in the service this morning, including our final hymn, Face to Face. When you read these words, or when you sing these words in just a minute, consider this. Face to face, I shall behold him far beyond the starry sky. Face to face, in all of his glory, I will see him by and by. Fanny Crosby was blind, but she lived her life looking for the day when she would see him face to face by and by. Let us make a commitment. Let me ask you to do two things this morning. Number one, I want you to ask yourself the question, what changes do I need to make in my life to focus on the one thing? And then ask, what can I do to help my church focus on the one thing?